So there's comedy, and then there's 1980s comedy. And somehow the era of Pac-Man and the Walkman managed to produce comedians and movies that remain in a league of their own. Stars like Bill Murray, Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi. They had talent and egos big enough to create some of the era's biggest movies. Beginning maybe with Animal House, but also Ghostbusters, The Blues Brothers, Beverly Hills Cop. And Nick Desimlian is features editor for Empire, the world's biggest movie magazine. He celebrates the feuds and friendships, the tragedies and blockbusters of the era in his new book, which is called Wild and Crazy Guys, How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. And Nick Desimlian is with us now. Hello there.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
What was it about that period that laid the foundation for what you call a new golden age of comedy to flourish?
It was just something very different about what these guys were doing. I think, comedy had been quite muted in the 70s and before. It was quite kind of conservative, and these guys brought a real sense of anarchy and ambition. And, they were just trying to push forward all the time, push against what they saw as kind of being the boundaries. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't.
There's an anecdote that you have Steve Martin watching the first episode of Saturday Night Live. That would have been mid-70s. And what did he say? Oh, sorry, are you still there? Yeah, there's an anecdote that you share about Steve Martin watching the premiere of Saturday Night Live in 1975. And what did he say to himself?
Yeah, he said, these guys have done it. They've done this new kind of comedy, which we've got in our heads. And I think there was just something about it. It's kind of amazing that these guys were all in the same place at the same time, just these huge personalities. And they all kind of converged on Saturday Night Live. A couple of them were up in Canada at SCTV. But yeah, they were all kind of just pushing things forward, all very different kind of personalities to each other. But together, they were kind of a formidable team.
And did all the fame and success in the 1980s come at a price for all of them in one way or another?
Yeah, they all adapted to it in different ways, and I think they all struggled with it in different ways. That's kind of one thing I get into in the book, is how kind of tough it was, even though these guys all made it and they became big stars. They all kind of had their own sort of stuff going on. John Belushi obviously died very young, got involved with a lot of drugs. That was a real tragedy. John Candy as well, really kind of tragic figure. He could have gone on to do some amazing dramatic work, I think. But yeah, I mean, even like Bill Murray, who seems to kind of cruise through the decade, everything he does pretty much is a hit. But even he really struggled with becoming famous, and he kind of disappeared off the map for 4 years after Ghostbusters, which is kind of mind-blowing.
I should point out too that this is quite a male story, and there were talented women around. Gilda Radner springs to mind, but they didn't sort of break out of TV and onto the big screen like the boys did.
Not really. I asked Ivan Reitman, the director of Ghostbusters, about this, and he said really, the stand-up scene and the comedy scene was a really male-orientated thing, and also the kind of films that were being greenlit were the big action movie. They had an element of action to them. And so the parts were kind of more male, Blues Brothers, Ghostbusters, things like that, Beverly Hills Cop. But it's true, there was definitely a certain sort of inbuilt sexism, I think. And John Belushi, as great as he was, kind of said at one point that he didn't think women were as funny as guys. And I think there was definitely a factor about at play, unfortunately.
So did all that testosterone and ego boil over from time to time?
Yeah, I mean, the book is full of, fist fights. It starts with a fist fight between Bill Murray and Chevy Chase. Chevy Chase had gone off to Hollywood. He was the first of these guys to make it big. And he went off and started doing films ahead of the rest of them. And then when he came back to New York to guest host on Saturday Night Live, everyone was kind of resentful of his ego and his arrogance. They saw it. And Bill Murray kind of stepped up and had this legendary fist fight with him backstage. I got to talk to Bill Murray about that himself, and he kind of plays it down. He says it was a Hollywood fight, a don't touch my face kind of fight, which is a description of it. But yeah, these guys were kind of unbridled, and they definitely, clashed from time to time. And Chevy Chase was often involved in those clashes.
they had some quite good verbal sparring during that physical altercation too.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Murray pointed at Chevy Chase and yelled, "Medium talent," which is an amazing insult.
And then there was John Belushi, who he had a reputation not so much for anger, but for being unpredictable, right? Which is, and studios don't like unpredictability. How did he end up getting the role in Animal House that essentially launched his movie career?
Well, John Landis, who directed Animal House, he watched Saturday Night Live. Pretty much everyone who was in the know was watching that show. And there was something about Belushi. He had this edge to him. He had this sense of danger. As you say, this kind of unpredictability to him. And I think that's exactly what he was after with the character of Bluto, who's just this enormous character, just causes anarchy everywhere he goes. And so Landis was determined to pin him down. And it took a bit of persuading. Belushi wasn't sure that he wanted to do it. He was shooting Saturday Night Live in New York at the time, so he was flying back and forth between SNL and Animal House, and he was exhausted the whole time. But it turned out to be a really good choice for him because that film was huge, and that really turned him into like an A-lister immediately.
You point out that actually didn't have a lot of lines in that. It was an on-screen presence that did it.
He doesn't have a lot of lines. He's not in it that much. You think of that film and you kind of think of him as being the main character, but you know, it's like Caddyshack with Bill Murray. Every moment he's on screen, he's doing something memorable, and he's definitely kind of the most iconic kind of part of that film, I think.
And then Belushi did Blues Brothers with Dan Aykroyd. Do you think that would that movie ever get the green light today? A road trip musical?
I don't think so. I mean, not even Aykroyd and John Landis could make it work twice. Blues Brothers 2000 is kind of a legendary disaster. It just doesn't work. I mean, I don't think it should have worked the first time. It's such a strange film. I love it. It's one of my favorites from that era. I absolutely adore the Blues Brothers. But you look at it and it's such a weird kind of combination of things. It's this giant car chase movie. It's a blues musical. It's very deadpan. It's got heroes who've got sunglasses on the whole time. It's just such a weird, eccentric film. And, you know, a lot of the films of that period flopped. The Blues Brothers was a hit. And I'm glad it was because it all kind of comes together and it works. But it's definitely a strange film.
Yeah. Quentin Tarantino says the 1980s were the worst decade for film except for the comedies. But you're right, there were a few stinkers. Any particularly memorable ones?
Well, I watched everything for the book. I've seen a lot of it already. I really kind of delved quite deep into all of the filmographies of these guys. And you kind of think of John Candy and you think of Planes, Trains and Automobiles and Uncle Buck and all these brilliant kind of classics. But he made a lot of very bad decisions, I think, as well. And you know, when he was starting out, he was kind of taking what he was offered, which wasn't great. So certainly some of his films are terrible. In terms of Chevy Chase, there's a movie called Oh Heavenly Dog, where it's a very strange film. Like he is literally,
I already know the premise from the title, Nick.
He's killed off. He goes in the body of a dog,
as you
might imagine, and he has to kind of find a serial killer. And it's a weird, like, depressing sort of, you know, it's a family film, but it's got swearing and murder in it. It's a real, and Chevy Chase himself says that he still hasn't seen it.
Okay, so which movie's the most underrated then?
Most underrated. There's a couple that I came across that actually I hadn't seen before. There's a really sweet film called Only the Lonely, which is a John Candy film, Ali Sheedy, and it's just a very, it's kind of quite a late John Candy film, but it's really, really sweet. And it's a romance, and it doesn't make a big deal of him, you know, being fat, which a lot of the scripts did. It just treats him like a regular guy, and so I really recommend that. And then Steve Martin really had trouble in the first half of the 80s getting a hit, and he kind of did a lot of experimental stuff trying to make something that would work and connect with audiences, and a lot of those films are really interesting. Pennies from Heaven, I would point out as being a really underrated Steve Martin film. It's not really a comedy, but it's a strange musical drama, and it's brilliant. He's fantastic in it.
And The Three Amigos.
Yeah, well, I can't count that as underrated because I love it so much. Maybe I love the Three Migos, and I got to do a Three Migos reunion
This
for
sounds so
Empire. We
cool.
got the guys back in their outfits and doing the salute. Chevy Chase couldn't remember how to do the salute, so Steve Martin had to remind him, and it was an amazing day.
I'm talking to Nick Dissemblian, by the way, who has a new book celebrating the great comedy movies of the 80s. It's called Wild and Crazy Guys: How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. Does John Belushi's death have a sense of inevitability about it, looking back from 2019?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to overemphasize just how hard living John Belushi was. He really, there was a famous book by Bob Woodward of Woodward and Bernstein, who wrote a book called Wired about Belushi, about the last days, last kind of couple of years in his life. John Landis says that's kind of an exaggeration, but even so, he was really kind of abusing his body in a big way, taking so many drugs, not sleeping. He was a real, genuine wild man, the kind that you don't really get in Hollywood anymore. So I think looking back, it was kind of inevitable. I think everyone saw that coming. John Candy, I think, was more of a shock, just because, there was no drugs involved. It was just, he couldn't stop eating, and that is a real tragedy. But John Belushi's death caused shockwaves that, all of these other guys were really affected by it in different ways.
You wonder what Ghostbusters would have been like if John Belushi had been in it as planned. Mind you, hard to think it would have been any more of a hit.
I don't know if it would have been a hit, because Dan Aykroyd's original draft, the one he wrote for Belushi, was really dark, apparently. That's what he says, and it's kind of set on another planet, apparently, and it was a completely different story, and it wouldn't have taken place in New York, and I wonder if it would have been a kind of a disaster. And there were other movies like Spies Like Us that was kind of originally meant to be a Belushi movie as well. So if Belushi hadn't died, it would have completely changed the rest of kind of 80s comedy history, which is kind of an interesting scenario to play out.
Is it true Bill Murray never read the scripts of Ghostbusters before arriving on the set?
That's what the director told me, Ivan Reitman. They had to push the start of the Ghostbusters shoot back because Bill Murray was off in Asia, kind of shooting his Somerset Maugham movie, which was his kind of personal project. He didn't want to do Ghostbusters. He wanted to make this drama, and about a guy on this voyage of self-discovery on the other side of the world. And he only agreed to do Ghostbusters if this movie got greenlit. So, apparently he wasn't particularly keen to do it, and Ivan Reitman said that he read the script in the limo on the way to the set on the first day, and it took him a while to kind of warm up.
He hated the fame that came with Ghostbusters, Bill Murray, and I wonder if eventually that might have served him well. That reluctance to feed the fame monster may have protected his sanity or his health or his career.
I think so. He really he was wary of becoming famous even before he had made a film. Meatballs was his first film. Ivan Reitman directed that as well, and he didn't really want to do that. He only kind of committed to it when it was already shooting. And he basically, when Ghostbusters came out, it was such a huge hit. He freaked out and he took 4 years off. He went to Paris. He studied philosophy at the Sorbonne. He just hung out in his house back in America, reading Irish novels. He really just wanted it all to quiet down, which is the opposite of really what most stars would do. And then I think that kind of reluctance was actually what made him become a even bigger star, because people would offer him movies, he would turn them down, and they got more and more desperate to get him back. And so his price would just keep going up and up. And so when he came back, he got this huge payday for Ghostbusters 2, and despite having been away for almost half a decade, he came back and everyone still loved him, and he's still getting huge roles.
Well, I don't know if you saw the conversation on Twitter a couple of weeks ago, the movie that you have to watch if it comes on TV, and the number one choice was Groundhog Day, right? If you turn the TV on, Groundhog Day is on, you can't help but watch the thing. Now, what's the story behind that? And we know that Tom Hanks turned it down, but it sounds like there was a lot of drama behind the scenes of that movie. What was going on?
There was a lot of drama. It was kind of the opposite of what Bill Murray was famous for. He was famous for not reading the script, but with Groundhog Day, he kind of secretly rewrote the script himself without telling the director, Harold Ramis, who was obviously his fellow Ghostbuster. They had this very dramatic falling out, the two of them, on Groundhog Day, to the point where Bill Murray and Harold Ramis were not talking to each other, or rather Bill Murray was not talking to Harold Ramis. Harold Ramis didn't really understand what was going on. And eventually one of the producers told Bill Murray he had to get an assistant so they could communicate between the two of them. And Bill Murray chose a deaf lady to come in.
Classic Bill Murray.
Classic Bill Murray. A very Bill Murray move. But yeah, it was really, it was a very troubled production, Groundhog Day. A lot of drama going on, a lot of fighting. Like I said, there were these two different versions of the script that they were constantly, the two sides were kind of fighting over which way the movie would go. And amazingly, it worked out perfectly. And despite all of that, or maybe because of it, we got an amazing movie out the other side.
How about Eddie Murphy? I remember someone a few years ago saying that Eddie Murphy sort of made the wrong choice when he stopped trying to be funny and started trying to be cool. Did you see any of that in the story as you look back?
Definitely. It's kind of funny just looking at the Beverly Hills Cops movies. The first movie, the original, his character Axel Foley is kind of the scrappy underdog. And, he's kind of comes to Hollywood and he's making fun of all the pretentious people. And then by the time we get to movie two, he's wearing an Armani suit and he's kind of become what he was mocking in the first film. And there was definitely a sense with Eddie Murphy that he started believing his own hype. And he went from being the kind of the wiseacre underdog who's poking fun at, the affluent people, to being more preoccupied with how cool he looks on screen. And then during Beverly Hills Cop 3, he actually issued a memo saying that the movie was no longer a comedy. and I talked to John Landis, who directed it, and Stephen E. D'Souza, who wrote it, and they both kind of talked about how, Eddie Murphy was actually making them get rid of jokes in the script because he decided he wanted to be an action star. And that happened at the kind of the beginning of the 90s. And I don't know why, because he was obviously one of the funniest men on the planet, but he decided that he didn't want to be a comedian for some reason. And it's a real shame.
John Landis was at the helm of so many of these movies. He must be like one of the most patient men in Hollywood, right?
Well, he and Eddie Murphy actually got into a punch-up on the set of Coming to America. And it's kind of amazing that they worked together again on Beverly Hills Cop 3, because that they had such a kind of a violent falling out. He worked with all of these guys, or nearly all of them. He did Trading Places, Blues Brothers. He's really behind a lot of these kind of iconic comedies. He talked about how Eddie Murphy changed over the decade. He worked with him on Trading Places, and he said he was quite a different person on Coming to America.
Hard to see that Steve Martin put much of a foot wrong, eh? Did you dig any dirt on him?
Not really. He's a kind of well-behaved guy, definitely compared to some of these others. He had a falling out with the writer of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. They had a bit of a fight over the character of Rupret the Monkey Boy, who's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
The Steve Martin character in that obviously kind of pretends to be this kind of quite strange guy with an eye patch as part of his and Michael Caine's kind of ploy to trick rich women. And he and the screenwriter had a bit of an argument over how lewd Rupret should be.
Mm-hmm.
But Steve Martin was, kind of a very cerebral guy, created a lot of the screenplays for his big movies himself. But it's interesting, in the 70s, he was this kind of rock star stand-up comedian who was doing these enormous arena shows. And he kind of embraced the rock and roll thing a little bit on stage. But then when he would come off stage, he would just go back to a hotel and read a book. So he's not so wild and crazy in real life.
And yet he's another one of these comedians who started veering maybe a little away from comedy and looking for drama or maybe even respect. Does it surprise you that this seems like a bit of a pattern that being funny and being successful in comedy doesn't seem to be enough.
Definitely not for these guys. You see almost all of them trying to make that transition to drama, and often successfully. You know, even Dan Aykroyd in Driving Miss Daisy, getting an Oscar nomination. John Candy in JFK is really good. Bill Murray wanted that right from the beginning. It felt like he was trying to go serious almost from the beginning. You know, playing Hunter S. Thompson in the kind of the biopic Where the Buffalo Roam, and they all could do it. They were all super talented and could do both. And Steve Martin is terrific when he decides to do something quite serious and intense, like Pennies from Heaven. He's really, really good.
Do you get excited about the reboots? Nah.
Well, I'm excited about the new Ghostbusters film. I'm intrigued. Dan Aykroyd is very much involved in all of the kind of the Ghostbusters stuff. They're talking about potentially doing two more films. So I'm excited to see what he's cooking up. I think there was an element of lightning striking at that time.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you can repeat Ghostbusters. There was just something about it that it was kind of scruffy around the edges.
Yeah.
At the same time, had the effects, and there was just something, and Dan Aykroyd taking the subject matter so seriously, he really believed in all that stuff. So I don't know if you can recreate that kind of in a lab, so to speak. So I don't know. And Coming to America 2, which is apparently shooting later this year, I'm kind of fascinated by that. I really do want to see Eddie Murphy coming back and being funny. So I'm crossing my fingers that'll happen.
Great. Hey, the book's called Wild and Crazy Guys, How the Comedy Mavericks of the 80s Changed Hollywood Forever. And the author is Nick Desemlian, who's also, by the way, features editor for Empire. And thank you so much for your time, Nick, and well done on the book.
Thank you so much. Thank you.